Virtual You, the radio program of self-exploration, where the focus is on our capacity to live consciously and fully, integrating the wisdom of spirit with practical affairs of science, business, and culture. Virtual You, presented by Wisdom Radio. And now your host, Jeffrey Mishlove.
Welcome to the second hour of my two-hour conversation with Professor Roger Walsh, member of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California at Irvine. Roger is author of Essential Spirituality, the Seven Central Practices to Awaken Heart and Mind, a wonderful book with a foreword by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Roger is also co-author with his wife, Frances Vaughn, of a couple of books, Paths Beyond Ego, and also Accept This Gift, Lessons from the Course in Miracles. Roger has written about shamanism, another of his books, which I had the privilege of interviewing him about for the Thinking Aloud television series, is called The Psychology of Human Survival. Welcome back, Roger.
Thank you, Jeff.
It's a pleasure to be with you now. We've been talking about the many different practices that are central to the world's spiritual traditions. We've talked about ethics. We've talked about transforming the emotions. We've talked about entering into a state of inner silence. One of the facets that I think all the world's spiritual traditions deal with is the question of healing. It seems as if when one leads a spiritual life, healing becomes sort of just a natural concomitant of that life. One becomes a healing person. It's sometimes thought of as a gift of the spirit.
Yes, and of course healing can be thought of in many ways. Usually we think of it as healing from some physical disease, or perhaps healing from some psychopathology, psychological disorder. But there's a more general and deeper sense of healing which is involved in the spiritual traditions, and that is the idea that all of us in some way are in need of a spiritual healing. That is, that we suffer in our usual condition from a case of mistaken identity. Our minds are clouded and out of control. As St. Paul said, we see through a glass darkly, or as Islam said, there are 70,000 veils between us and Allah. We are not who we can be, and actually we're not who we truly are. At least we're not aware of who we truly are. So one can think of a spiritual path and practice as being oriented towards healing our less than fully developed state of mind or state of being, and bringing us to true health. Now that process, that practice, that direction which spiritual practice takes on is, can be thought of in many ways. And of course there are a series of metaphors. One can think of it as an unfolding of our true potential, or a metamorphosis. Just as the caterpillar becomes a butterfly, so we too go from identifying merely with our bodies to recognizing that we're also spiritual beings. Or we can think of it as the metaphor of a journey, or we can think of it as a metaphor for death, of death and rebirth. We die to the old person that we thought we were. We recognize we're not who we thought we were. We let that go, and we are reborn as a more, with a more mature, more spiritual, more encompassing self-image. And of course, that self-image itself must be relinquished and die, until eventually what's reborn is that which can never die. And so too, one of these metaphors is of healing, that the idea that our usual state of being is in some way distorted and disturbed, and that we need to heal ourselves, particularly heal our minds. One finds at the heart of the, what we might call the perennial psychology, that understanding of the nature of the psyche, which is common to the contemplative traditions around the world, the recognition that our usual state of mind is in some way suboptimal. It's our usual mind is out of control, as you said, very busy, frenetic, hyperactive, that we our awareness is clouded, our emotions are jangled, our attention is scattered. We are less than who we can be, and our minds are far less than they can be. So in some ways, as it said, we're prisoners of our own mind. And this recognition is the first step to freedom. We have to first of all recognize that our minds are largely out of control and underdeveloped before we can begin working on them to heal them and whole them.
Let me ask you this, though, Roger. You are a professor of psychiatry. You've written many books on the spiritual path. You've been practicing spiritual disciplines now for years, decades. Would you say that that statement applies to you, that your mind is largely out of control and undeveloped?
I certainly would. I think one of the things that happens with spiritual practices and meditation is one gains a greater capacity to introspect, to look within, to see the nature of our mind, and one finds that yes, things aren't as together in there as I thought. And of course, years and a couple of decades of practice does begin the healing process, but my own healing process is far from complete. Certainly my mind feels a lot more pleasant and easier to be with than part of than it did 10 or 15 years ago, but there's still much work to do. I feel like I've gained enormously from doing these practices, and I'm very grateful to them. I'm just a lot happier and calmer and more content than I ever was before I began them. But I can also see how much further there is to go, and that the great religious saints and sages, the people who truly did these practices fully and came to a very profound understanding of their own minds and a profound healing of them, were truly masters of this inner realm, who did an extraordinary amount of inner work and healed and hold themselves to degrees far beyond my own.
Mm-hmm. And so they ultimately are the role models for you, the people to whom you would compare yourself, or the great spiritual heroes of humanity.
Well, in one sense, I think there are role models for us all. And you mentioned, for example, the Dalai Lama is a beautiful example.
As opposed, let us say, to the great psychiatrists.
Well, I think there's better, I think it's useful to have a variety of heroes. Actually, as one person said, tell me who a person's heroes are, and I'll tell you who that person is and what they're like. And for myself, it seems to make sense to have a variety of heroes, not in the sense of hero worship that we abase ourselves before, but rather as exemplars of what we can be, that these people who are role models for us show us our own potentialities. They show us what we possess latent within us and can cultivate and develop. Mm-hmm. And so... and certainly so to have, say, some of the great mental health professionals and healers, and certainly, above all, some of the great saints and sages as our role models, makes an enormous difference. If you think of the cultural heroes that our culture holds up, Hollywood movie stars and people with various kinds of dysfunctional lifestyles of one kind or another, give me the great spiritual heroes anytime.
Well, I interrupted your train of thought, I think, because you were talking about healing, and I think what you were leading up to is the power of awareness as a tool for healing.
Yes, very much so, and this is one of the interesting areas of convergence between contemporary psychology and ancient wisdom. And one finds that contemporary psychology is basically, in many ways, rediscovering the healing power of awareness. If we go back 2,500 years, the Buddha diagnosed our problem as mindlessness, that is, our usual lack of awareness, the scattering of attention and mind that most of us suffer from, and said that mindfulness, that is, clear awareness, is valuable everywhere. And in our own time, we have psychologists such as Fritz Perls, who said that awareness in and of itself is healing.
Mm-hmm. I'm of the impression that, in particular with Vipassana meditation, that just the simple awareness does have a healing impact.
Very much so, and there's a lot of evidence for that now. The laboratory research is making very clear that some of these awareness meditation practices can have profound effects on body and mind, and very beneficial effects.
Such
as letting go of addictions, exactly. Mm-hmm. People who do these awareness practices tend to be less addicted and to use less drugs, both legal and illegal.
I'm talking with Professor Roger Walsh, author of Essential Spirituality, Exercises from the World's Religions. We'll return after these messages from Wisdom Radio.
Green and Oprah Winfrey showed millions how to lose weight and keep it off in their book, Make the Connection. Their combination of diet and moderate exercise has helped a nation and has become an inspirational classic. Now, in Keep the Connection, Bob Green shows us how to keep the momentum going. The fitness expert who helped Oprah lose weight and get into shape shares his secrets for how to become even more fit and healthy in all aspects of life, from diet and exercise to how to stay motivated. This book will take you to the next level of health, fitness, and positive attitude. Purchase your copy of Keep the Connection for $19.95 by calling 1-888-947-3669. That's 1-888-WISDOM-9.
Notes to Myself. Hugh Prather's exploration into the deeper issues of psychological development inspired millions to look inward and map a path of spiritual growth through self-discovery. Now, Hugh inspires us again with his inner wisdom. Spiritual Notes to Myself calls on spiritual seekers to not only look inward, but outward at what connects us to one another as human beings. Spiritual Notes to Myself is a unique blend of inspiration, encouragement, no-nonsense advice, and humor. Hugh and his wife Gail bring that same warm and inviting style to spiritual parenting. This book shares with us principles and practices to help us understand and nurture our children at home, in school, and in the world. Purchase both books for $22.95 by calling 1-888-947-3669. That's 1-888-WISDOM-9.
Children live in a world of wonderment. Their imaginations know very few boundaries. Teacher and writer Richard Lewis considers the life of the imagination as a necessary part of every child's growing consciousness. In his book, Living by Wonder, Lewis explores the diverse facets of a child's imagination and its rich expression through language, play, art, stories, and poetry. This book is a must for anyone interested in the emotional, spiritual, and intellectual life of childhood. It's importance lies not only in its application to children, but also in its exploration of values we, adults, need to keep alive in ourselves and our communities. Call 1-888-947-3669 to order your copy of Living by Wonder for $18.95. The number is 1-888-WISDOM-9. Explore your possibilities with Wisdom Radio.
Welcome back to Virtual You. I'm your host, Jeffrey Mishlove, and my guest today is Professor Roger Walsh. His book, Essential Spirituality, Exercises from the World's Religions to Cultivate Kindness, Love, Joy, Peace, Vision, Wisdom, and Generosity. At the end of our last segment, we were beginning to touch on Vipassana meditation and the idea that it could actually be used to overcome addictions. I think it's worth exploring that more because one might say that the fundamental problem of humanity in general is addiction.
Yes, there's certainly that idea, which is increasingly widespread in our own culture. There's a recognition of the power and pervasiveness of addiction, and it's certainly central to the world's spiritual traditions. In the West, we've usually thought of addictions as, you know, we've limited to things like drugs or food. That's been the main way we've thought of it. But I think we're increasingly coming to recognize that addiction is a central dynamic in our lives and our culture, and that much of the dysfunction in our own individual lives and in the culture at large can be traced to our addictive behavior, and that we can become addicted to almost anything: status, money, power, self-image, cars, whatever, you name it, we can become addicted to it. The untrained mind, the unenlightened mind, seems to have this natural tendency to grasp onto things in the desperate and hopeless quest for some enduring happiness. And this, of course, is in some ways a direct rediscovery of ancient wisdom. One finds in each of the great religious traditions the idea that addiction or craving brings suffering. It's not that the things of the world themselves are bad, but when we become attached to them, when we become addicted, then we're setting ourselves up to suffer. And it was most centrally and essentially stated by the Buddha, who laid out his fundamental understandings and what he called the Four Noble Truths. And the first of them was that difficulty is part of life. And the second was that our suffering is a reflection of our addictions. Craving or addiction brings suffering. And it's a very interesting exercise if you start to look around, look at your life and think of any kind of psychological pain, whether it's anxiety, fear, depression, jealousy. It's very interesting to look and see if you can find an example which isn't directly due to addiction of some way. I find it's very hard for me in my own life to come up with difficult psychological experiences which aren't a reflection of my own addictions.
Now, by addiction, what if you're grieving the loss of a friend?
Yeah, that's a difficult one, and I wrestle with how to conceptualize that in my own mind, Jeff. Let me just put out something because I don't really understand this fully, and maybe we can explore it a little bit. I think what some of the great religious traditions would say is that a truly enlightened person, a person who was really wise and mature, would be able to love without addiction. Mm. And would definitely miss and regret the loss of a loved one, but would not suffer in the same tragic and overwhelming way that the rest of us do. Now, you know, I can't speak from my own experience. I'm not mm-hmm. there. I know that, you know, on the occasions when I've lost a love, even if it's not when they've died, but just lost the end of a relationship, I've suffered enough. Now, you know, I can see that that's a result of my own craving and addiction and needs, and maybe if I was more mature, I wouldn't have those feelings, but I'm not there. So I can only kind of guess at how someone who was truly wise and mature would feel, but certainly, I think what all of us can see is that certainly some of the suffering we experience when we part with people and when we lose people is a result of our own addiction and craving above and beyond the natural expression of love.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I understand the Vipassana technique correctly, it's one in which you observe that craving. You become still enough inside so that when a craving arises, you're able to notice it without identifying with it.
Yes, that's a good description. Vipassana, or otherwise known as insight meditation, is the central meditation of Buddhism, which, of course, is also found in other traditions in Taoism. It's the method of internal observation. And the essence of the practice is that you bring a clear, inquiring awareness to any and every experience that arises. So whatever experiences come up, you explore them. And when craving or addiction arises, instead of automatically responding by running to the refrigerator or running off to the mall to buy something and satisfy the addiction, instead you first take time to just look at it. And what is striking is that when we act unconsciously simply to fulfill an addiction, then we reinforce it. And the heroin addict who needs a fix, as soon as he shoots up, he's reinforcing and strengthening the addiction. The person who's attached to food and feels a pang of hunger and races for the fridge reinforces that addiction. But on the other hand, someone who's trained in a meditation, which they've learned to bring awareness to their experience, when an addiction comes up, instead of acting on it automatically and reinforcing and strengthening it, they can just take a moment and bring awareness to that experience. And what they find is that when they are really aware of the experience of craving, when they investigate it, explore it, they, as you said, don't identify with it. They don't feel like helpless victims of it. They recognize that they have a choice, and that bringing awareness to the emotion, that craving feeling, actually tends to weaken it. So awareness can be healing, and that awareness can become particularly profound and penetrating when it's strengthened through a meditative practice.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of people actually giving up heroin addictions through meditative practice.
That's interesting. I suspect that's true. I'm trying to remember if I've known any patients myself who've used it to do that. I can't recall any. But certainly there's a lot of evidence that people who take up meditation tend to use less illegal drugs, and even less legal drugs, alcohol and nicotine, mm-hmm. which, of course, are some of the most dangerous.
Mm-hmm. And the practice of awareness, it seems to me, can also be used to deal with physical pain, much the same as with addiction.
Yes, very much so. And there's been a very interesting series of studies and clinical applications done at various universities. Best known is the Stress Management Clinic at the University of Massachusetts in Worcester, led by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who uses awareness meditation or Vipassana or insight meditation, and he works with people with chronic pain. Some of the most difficult patients of all in medicine, people with chronic pain, have a very hard time. It's hard to work with them. It's hard to offer them a lot. But Jon Kabat-Zinn has had a remarkable success with these people by training them to, when pain arises, not to flinch and pull back, as most of us automatically do, but rather to do what almost seems counterintuitive, that is to turn attention towards the pain, to explore it and work with it consciously. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, these people have found that they're able to, that the pain becomes more manageable and they're able to go on with their lives in ways which they weren't before. Mm-hmm. Jon Kabat-Zinn has really had a remarkable impact on our understanding of pain management and stress management.
I've had the same experience in my own psychotherapy practice, that for people who learned long ago, you know, such techniques as blocking the pain, distracting the mind, and then they'd reach a level of pain where that wouldn't work, they were able to learn to live with the pain by moving into it rather than away from it.
That's a nice example, I think, of the general principle, yes, that awareness can... our automatic response is to pull back, but we can learn to bring awareness to these difficult experiences. In doing so, they sometimes become manageable.
And it seems to me that there's an important spiritual principle behind all of this, which is that the mind normally does tend to wall off pain, to avoid it, to become numb to pain. And in so doing, we in effect become numb to the pain and the suffering in the world around us. It's our way of, you know, creating a little island of serenity for ourselves. But when we wall ourselves off from the pain of others, we lose touch with an important part of ourself, and in particular with our capacity for compassion, which is also at the core of spiritual traditions.
Well said. Yes, I think that's very true. In fact, the willingness to open to the suffering of others is the requirement for the development of compassion. And of course, compassion is regarded as one of the central and crucial emotions for all of us on the spiritual path.
It seems to me, if we're going to make a world that really works for everybody, that to base it on compassion is essential.
Yes, compassion, it's hard to do better than compassion.
My guest is Roger Walsh, author of Essential Spirituality. We'll return after these messages.
There's a positive, hopeful trend occurring throughout the world. According to Alan Mesher, the author of The T-Zone, The Path to Inner Power, that trend is the movement of millions of people towards spiritual enlightenment and inner fulfillment. Mesher's book attempts to help spiritual seekers encounter what he calls deeply embedded negative tendencies from the past, so they can move forward into a brighter, more creative future. Mesher, a gifted healer who has applied these principles to assist thousands of people, says the T-Zone will help locate the key to true personal freedom. Purchase your copy of The T-Zone for $14.95 by calling 1-888-947-3669. That's 1-888-WISDOM-9.
Harvesting the first tomato from the garden, marking new and full moons, saying grace and evening prayers, All these are part of Goddess Celebration. The book, Circle Round, lovingly shows that way to share this celebration with children. Circle Round encourages us to gently open children's awareness to the sacredness of life, our connection to Mother Earth, and our responsibility to preserve her gifts. At a time when child rearing is intensely affected by the stresses of modern life, Starhawk, Diane Baker, and Ann Hill offer new ways to foster a strong sense of family. Within the pages of this book are new traditions, meaningful and symbolic, to bring into your home. Call 1-888-947-3669 to purchase your copy of Circle Round for $25.95. 1-888-WISDOM-9.
Hello, shoppers. Welcome to Shop Wrong. Check out today's circular for all the damage you can do to the environment. On aisle 6, pick up a serving of air pollution. Deplete double the natural resources with our special in-store coupon.
Every time you go shopping, you have a choice. Buy products made with too much packaging, but then you're buying trash. Or shop smart by buying products in bulk, avoiding single serves, and replacing disposables with things you can reuse, which saves energy, natural resources, and means less pollution.
Excuse me, where can I find the water pollution section?
We stock that on aisle 7.
Thank you. Buy smart, waste less, save more.
For more information, call 1-800-CALL-EDF. A message from the Ad Council and the Environmental Defense Fund.
Grace is the church's great distinctive. It's the one thing the world cannot duplicate and the one thing it craves above all else, for only grace can bring hope and transformation to a jaded world. In What's So Amazing About Grace, award-winning author Philip Yancey explores grace at street level. If grace is God's love for the undeserving, he asks, then what does it look like in action? And how are we doing at lavishing grace on a world that knows far more of cruelty and unforgiveness than it does mercy? Yancey sets grace in the midst of life's stark images and tests its mettle against ungrace. In his most personal and provocative book ever, Yancey offers compelling true portraits of grace's life-changing power, and he challenges us to become living answers to a world that desperately wants to know what's so amazing about grace. Purchase your copy for $19.99. Call 1-888-947-3669, 1-888-WISDOM-9.
Welcome back to Virtual You. I'm your host, Jeffrey Mishlove. I'm interviewing Professor Roger Walsh of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California at Irvine. Dr. Walsh is author of numerous books relating spiritual practice to modern psychology. We're talking about essential spirituality, the seven central practices to awaken heart and mind. One of those practices is the cultivation of gratitude.
Yes, most of us think that if things go our way, we can be grateful, or that if we're happy, we can be grateful. But what we don't understand is that we can be grateful, and that will make us happy. Mm. And so it kind of turns things around, and gratitude is actually a wonderful practice. And Brother David Stindlerast, a Christian monk, has written a nice book on this, pointing out that when you practice gratitude, it opens our hearts to love, and it increases our own sense of happiness and well-being. In our culture, most of us, a lot of us are very blessed and fortunate. Of course, there are still many people within our culture who are living difficult lives, but most of us have things we can be grateful for, and each of us has a choice as to what we focus on. We can focus on those people and situations which are difficult to be with, and if we do, we'll probably end up feeling angry and resentful. Or we can focus on those situations and people and blessings within our lives which make us feel good. And to the extent we focus on those, then we tend to feel better, and we can also practice gratitude. Now, of course, this has been formalized in various ways, as, for example, the practice of saying grace before we eat. they're taking a moment to recognize that this is a gift from both the earth and from the universe and from the divine. And by just taking a moment to feel that gratitude, we orient our lives towards an appreciation of our own good fortune. We cultivate feelings of well-being and joy, and we recognize our interconnection with other people. For example, the Zen practitioners, before they eat, say, innumerable labors brought us this food. We should remember how it came to us, with the idea that, you know, to get a plate of food on our table took farmers and truck drivers and packers and grocerymen and checkout people and innumerable people working to bring that food from the earth to us, and of course the earth itself and the sun all did their part. So our meal is actually a reflection of the bounty of the earth and the sun and of the work of innumerable people, so that by bringing that to awareness, we can recognize our interdependence on many people, the gratitude we owe them. And then this next line from the Zen grace says, innumerable labors brought us this food. We should see that our practice deserves it, so that we can practice our spiritual life. We can practice qualities such as gratitude and joy and love as a way of expressing our thankfulness.
Mm. Well, I suppose that's even more meaningful in the life of a Buddhist monk who may be surviving because of the donations of other people through begging.
Yes, of course, for the traditional monks and nuns who set aside worldly concerns and are to a significant extent dependent on the community for their support, then this gratitude is very deeply placed and appropriate. Though, of course, it's recognized in the, for example, Buddhist communities that it's a two-way street, that the monks and nuns are dependent for the lay people in their community for physical support and food, and on the other hand, the monks and nuns have a responsibility to the lay community to do a couple of things. One is to practice their spiritual work as deeply as they can so as to cultivate spiritual qualities, and the second is to offer themselves to the community to serve, to help, to teach, to help, to heal, and to teach. So it's very much a two-way process in which both groups have something to be grateful for.
Mm-hmm. Well, for the average layperson who may not be surrounded by Buddhist monks, it seems to me there's still many reasons to feel grateful. Even in the most wretched of circumstances, life itself is a gift.
Life itself is a gift, and each thing in life comes to us as a gift, to the extent we can see things that way. And there's actually a remarkable shift in perception that occurs as we cultivate gratitude and do spiritual practices. It's sometimes described as a shift in perception that goes from in paranoia, in which paranoia we project our anger outward and see it project it coming back at us. We project our anger outwards and become concerned that people are out to attack us. But then when we cultivate feelings of love and gratitude and joy within us, then we tend to project that out, and we develop what's called pronoia, in which we see people around us wanting to help and to heal and to serve us in many ways.
And pronoia, like that.
Yes, and then there's the concept of that pronoia can mature into transnoia, in which we see the world as this gigantic spiritual school place in which everyone is playing their perfect part as a teacher for us to help us learn and grow and awaken.
And I've also heard the term metanoia.
Yes, metanoia, I think, is a Christian term and describes a profound turning around of awareness, a transformation of awareness at a very deep level.
Mm-hmm. So all of these things sort of go into that cultivation of an attitude of gratitude, which I suppose is just the opposite of an attitude of envy.
Very, very nicely put. Yes, envy is craving after and resenting what other people have, gratitude is an appreciation and gratitude for what we already have, not basing our happiness on getting more, but rather basing our happiness on what we already have. It's a much better recipe, more effective recipe, because we can be grateful. And if we're grateful, we can be happy now. If we're jealous, we can only be happy down the line if we happen to get what other people want.
And which is often what people use, that kind of reasoning, to say postpone a life of service, a life of charity. It's like, when my ship comes in, then I'll be able to do those things. Whereas an attitude of experiencing gratitude for what one has now, one would be much more inclined to be of service right now to other people.
Exactly. Gratitude makes for happiness, and happiness makes for a desire to help others. It's very clear that from the research that people who feel happy are much more likely to be helpful to others and generous than are people who feel less happy. And there's even a wonderful phenomenon called the paradox of happiness, which is that paradoxically, people who devote more time to helping others tend to be happier. Than people who devote all their time and energy to making themselves happy. So it's an interesting example of contemporary research catching up with ancient claims.
Yeah. One study that I had heard of measured the level of happiness amongst the Asian peoples. And when I heard that study report, I think it was Peter Russell mentioned this in a lecture, that the least happy people in all of Asia were the Japanese. Who are the wealthiest. And the most happy people amongst the Asians were the Filipinos, who are amongst the poorest. But when you know Filipinos, they're always singing and dancing.
Interesting. Yes, I don't know that study, but it sounds like one more example of the fact that money is not a terribly good predictor of happiness.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know how it would correlate in terms of the Filipinos being more of service or more giving, but I do know this, that the Filipino amas, they're called, are sought after all over Asia to be the caretakers of children.
Interesting. Yes, I don't know that either.
Mm-hmm. But in any case, the spiritual traditions all talk about the necessity of service in the world, of making a contribution.
Yes, service is seen in some cases even regarded as the supreme virtue of all the virtues that are worth cultivating. And Muhammad, for example, regarded service as the optimal practice one could do, the final goal of a spiritual life. And we find this running through each of the great traditions, the idea that we work, we do our spiritual practice, we learn, we grow, not just for ourselves alone, but for the benefit of everyone. And that our spiritual practice ideally becomes a gift to all beings, even all creatures. And that this is the best, one of the great gifts we can give.
We will return to conclude our program with Dr. Roger Walsh after these messages.
The wisdom, warmth, compassion, and disarming candor of Simple Abundance have made Sarah Bond Bronix a trusted voice to millions of women. Now Sarah invites you on a bold, brave, and beautiful continuation of the journey to authenticity. Her book, Something More, is eloquent and evocative. In it, she encourages you to become an archaeologist for yourself, to plumb your past with its unfulfilled longings, forgotten pleasures, and abandoned dreams, to excavate the authentic woman buried inside. Uncovering your authentic self will be challenging, but exhilarating. Along the way, you will experience small but exquisite epiphanies that will help you come to terms with your past choices and reveal new exciting opportunities. Purchase your copy of Something More for $20 by calling 1-888-WISDOM-9 or by visiting us online at wisdomradio.com.
The planets can help you discover yourself. They can help you understand your children from the moment they are born. They can help you build stronger and longer-lasting relationships. No One is a Mystery is a book that will help you put the knowledge of the planets to work in your life. well-known Western astrologer Randall Curtis helps us discover the psychic meaning of the planets so we can contact the hidden side of human nature and gain a profound understanding of why we do the things we do. He uses clear, easy-to-understand language to help us all tap into the gifts available to us through astrology. Purchase your copy of No One is a Mystery for $15.95 by calling 1-888-947-3669. That's 1-888-WISDOM-9.
Homer's Odyssey took us on a quest for adventure. Spiritual teacher Deepak Chopra also takes us on a quest, but his journey goes within to unveil the core of who we are. In The Way of the Wizard, you'll discover 20 spiritual lessons that will help you chart a course for growth and transformation. Read this book and be prepared to move from a life dominated by the ego to a freer life that makes room for the miraculous. Chopra offers more guidance in The Seven Spiritual Laws of Success. Within its pages, you'll find a profound outline for conducting your life at the highest and most integrated level. Chopra distills the essence of his teachings into seven simple yet powerful principles that can easily be applied to all aspects of your life. Purchase The Way of the Wizard and The Seven Spiritual Laws of Success for $26.95. The number is 1-888-WISDOM-9.
Cultivating life is an act of love. That's the message Thomas More brings us in his latest book. More helped us care for our souls. Now he's finding the connection between spirituality and sex. It's tempting to think of human sexuality in terms of biology and interpersonal relationships. But in The Soul of Sex, Moore tells us sex is an experience of the soul, and he emphasizes the themes of fantasy, desire, meaning, and morality. This is a book for anyone who wants to explore their sexuality with honesty, appropriate emotional complexity, civility, and comfort. Call 1-888-947-3669 to order your copy of The Soul of Sex for $25. That's 1-888-WISDOM-9. Enrich your life. Wisdom Radio.
Welcome to the final segment of my two-hour conversation with Dr. Roger Walsh, author of Essential Spirituality, The Seven Central Practices to Awaken Heart and Mind. I think there's something of a dichotomy or conflict, minor perhaps, within the spiritual community between those people who feel that spiritual work is something that is done inwardly within oneself and those who feel that what's really needed isn't more meditation or sometimes it's referred to almost derogatorily as navel contemplation.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really needed is action in the world, that we have to create a better world. We have to seek justice, and it strikes me that ultimately both are needed, and that the world as a whole stands in need of healing. And I'm thinking of the idea from the Jewish Kabbalah that the goal of mysticism is to sort of liberate spirit in the world, and that it has somehow become imprisoned. And that we have to heal the world.
Yes, well, certainly a glance around at the world or reading a newspaper makes clear that our world is in dire need of healing. And, it's really interesting, Jeff. You look around at the global problems we're facing, overpopulation, pollution, ecological decay, warfare, threat of nuclear weapons. It's very interesting. For the first time in human history, each and every one of the great threats we face is human-caused.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that the state of the world in some way reflects the state of our individual and collective minds, that that these great crises we're facing are human creations, which means they stem from our own behavior, which means that they are in some way the reflections of our own ways of thinking and feeling and perceiving and acting. So that from that perspective, the great global crises are actually global symptoms. They're symptoms of our individual and collective psychological and spiritual dysfunctions. And what that suggests is that if we are to truly heal our global crises, we need not only to feed the hungry and reduce nuclear stockpiles and reduce pollution, which we certainly need to do, but we also need to understand the psychological forces within us and between us which led to the creation of these problems in the first place. So we need to work at multiple levels. We need to work in the world. We need to work politically and economically. But we also need to work psychologically and spiritually to get to the really fundamental roots of these crises. And unless we do so, we're really only dealing with these problems symptomatically and superficially.
Einstein, I believe, once said that no problem can be solved from the state of mind in which it was created.
Well, he may very well have a point there. Certainly the state of mind which created these global crises, which has led to, you know, such warfare and pollution, etc., is going to need to be transformed. And it's very interesting, you know, if you look around at the state of the world, it's hard to find a global problem which does not reflect a lack of spiritual qualities such as love and compassion and wisdom and generosity. And so clearly what is needed is work in the world, service, contribution, etc., but also work both individually and collectively to educate our population about the possibility of cultivating these qualities, of developing greater love and compassion and wisdom, both individually and collectively as a culture. And it may be that we're in a race between consciousness and catastrophe, and that unless we do modify our collective consciousness, unless we do develop these spiritual capacities, unless we do foster greater wisdom and love and compassion and generosity, that we really won't adequately respond to these crises.
Yeah. I think there's a paradox in there once. I remember 30 years ago or so, 25, I met with a Sufi teacher, Idris Shah, and we were talking about the world and the trouble that the world is in, and as you put it, this race between consciousness and catastrophe. And he said, yes, it's true, but if people attempt to achieve higher consciousness in order to avoid a catastrophe, that's the wrong motivation. They won't get there.
Yes, that's an interesting statement. I suspect that what he was pointing to was the idea that the primary motivation for our development, both individual and collective, the spiritual traditions would say needs to be spiritual. It can't be instrumental. It can't be that we do spiritual practices just to have a particular effect. It needs to be a deeper, broader motive than that.
Or if there's some sort of fear that's driving it.
Oh, good point. Yes, that may be part of it, just for sure. Very good point.
Because I personally think for myself that spiritual attitude is a very practical attitude, that it can be instrumental, and there's nothing wrong with that, that's what's needed. But that if there's a motive out of fear, especially, say, fear for one's own survival, that there may be something flawed in all of that. After all, we're all going to die.
Yes, that's true. And I like your point about not that these practices are best done not out of fear, but out of some deeper motive, which is a more authentic and effective motive.
The traditions that you have been talking about all seem to be designed isn't the right word, but inspired to cultivate love.
Yes, very much so. And certainly, it's as we can take a look around at the world around us, it's certainly a quality which is desperately needed. And yes, love is the emotion which is the central emotion underlying each of these traditions. The Buddhists would say maybe compassion, so they would give compassion a slight edge over love. But the other traditions, love is the emotional quality par excellence.
And I think in many traditions, I don't know how the Buddhists feel about this, but many traditions say God is love, or that ultimate reality is fundamentally loving, so that while we are experiencing this sense of lack of love in the human world, love is really everywhere.
Yes, there's a common theme suggesting that love is not only personal but transpersonal, not only mundane but divine, and that the love which we're used to experiencing in our daily lives is actually just the kind of tip of the iceberg or tip of the spiritual iceberg, and that for those of us who cultivate love more deeply through spiritual practice, that we do come to taste a love which is infinite, part of our very nature, part of the nature of reality, of mm-hmm. the universe, and a love which is so much more than we can imagine, that it does take us to the divine and, mm-hmm. and seems to be a very inherent part of the universe.
That it's like if we just quiet down enough, the love is in every molecule, it's in every vibration. The universe exists because of an act of divine love. The Buddhists, though, it seems, say no, it's a little different than that. At the basis is nirvana, which is nothingness and emptiness. It's not the same.
This is a somewhat tricky issue, but
especially to end on. But
right? Yes, I think they would say that emptiness, or shunyata, as it's called, is what gives birth to love and compassion. So they're intimately linked.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Roger Walsh, it has been a great joy and pleasure and an enlightening experience for me and for our Wisdom Radio audience to share these 2 hours with you. Thank you so much.
It's been a delight. Thank you, Jeff.
And we have about a half a minute left. Roger, do you have a final thought you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I think the underlying thought has been here that we are far more than we think, and that it's possible for us to realize that potential through spiritual practice.
Thank you again, Roger Walsh, author of Essential Spirituality.
You're listening to an original production of Wisdom Radio, LLC, copyright 2000, all rights reserved. Visit us on the web at wisdomradio.com. Send email to info@wisdomradio.com and call 1-888-WISDOM-9 to order a copy of today's program or other products from the Wisdom Store. This is Wisdom Radio.